Charles James Gordon Bruce, age 27. Freddie Cade, age 33. Harold Elgar, age unknown. Henry Alfred Fish, age 21. Thomas Jolly, age unknown. Thomas Edgar Boyle, age 20. Henry Edward Pratt, age unknown. Thomas Stuart Pittman, age 26. Jeffrey Gladstones, age 24.
Those names are names from the past, ghosts of the Ypres salient. And for anyone that's been to the Tynecot Cemetery and Memorial, close to Passchendaele, they'll be familiar with those sounds, those names of the long dead. Because as you walk down the path at the back of the cemetery towards the visitor centre, those are a few of the 100-odd names that are read out in rotation to make us think about those young men that died along the Passchendaele Ridge and the other low ridges around that surrounded Ypres between 1914 and 1918. Not all of the names that are read out are those men that are remembered at Passchendaele. Some of them are in the other cemeteries and the other memorials on the salient.
Cecil Ernest Bartlett, age 27. Edward Thomas Sandell, age unknown. Guy Collins Vernon Taylor, age unknown. Thomas William Gain, age unknown. Alfred George Inch, age 20. John Septimus Morris, age 20. Eric Harold Ellis Delacy, age unknown.
I don't know about you, but for those of you that have been to the Tynecot Visitor Centre, whenever I hear those voices being read out, it has a profound effect on me. And it was those voices that gave me the idea of trying to find out a bit more about and it was listening to that voice read out those names that gave me the idea of trying to find out some more about just a few of the soldiers that are on the semicircular wall at the back of the Tynecot Cemetery, the Tynecot Memorial to the Missing, that contains the names of nearly 35,000 soldiers that died and have no known grave on the salient between 1914 and 1918. And I thought, well, I can't do this on my own. I've got a few stories that I've collected over the years. But a good friend of mine is called Johan de Jong. And for regular visitors at Tynecot, they'll have seen Johan wandering around, sometimes guiding, sometimes on his own. He's a man that's lived very close to the cemetery all of his life. And he's appeared on the podcast House on the Battlefield once before, a couple of years ago. We looked at some of the men that are buried in the cemetery. And so I asked Johan to come on again on a very cold morning at the beginning of January. He took me on a tour around the memorial and he talked about some of the stories. Some are quite well known, some have never been told before. But they're all incredible stories that Johan is now going to share with us as this week's podcast comes live from the Tynecot Memorial.
Right, well, on a I think it's 1 degree in the car, it said, on the way up. We've had all sorts of weather today. It started off beautiful first thing this morning, and then I was out cycling and the heavens opened, and we've had sleet and snow and wind and rain and we've had everything, haven't we? Now find myself standing at Tynecot, a familiar place to so many people, looking back across the battlefield all the way back to Ypres. We can now see it as the sun's come out, the wintry sun here. I think there's one other person, isn't there, in Tynecot, apart from myself and Johan de Jong here, my good friend. And we've come today. A couple of years ago we did a podcast, it really was 2 years ago, we did a podcast here about some of the men beneath the headstones here in the cemetery, the 12,000 here. But then there's another, what, nearly 35,000 names on the semicircular wall that surrounds the Tynecott Cemetery. These are the names of the men that they couldn't fit on the Menin Gate that died. I think the cut-off date was the 16th of August 1917. So if the men died after that, then they'll be, their names will be generally remembered on this wall here at Tynecott. But first of all, Johan, you better explain why Tynecott is such a passion. You live nearby and you always have, I understand.
Yes, I live very close to the cemetery. I'm grown up as a young boy on the battlefields, going with my father on the fields, picking up some shrapnel balls, visiting some cemeteries and getting interested in the headstones, and especially in the stories of those behind the headstones, and also about the missing souls, because so many people died here just for this few miles of ground here in Passchendaele.
It really is your home, and I know you do a lot of volunteering. What else do you, I know you do guiding, but what else do you do here?
Yes, I'm a semi-professional battlefield tour guide, but I'm also volunteering in the Passchendaele Society 1970, which is supporting the Passchendaele Museum. But I'm also volunteering at the Commonwealth War Graves Visitor Centre in Ypres. I'm helping at Hoo Hoo Crater. I do a lot of things to remember all these boys and to make sure that we don't forget their stories.
It's a big passion, isn't it? And it's another symbol of friendship, isn't it, that we're here doing this today. The friendship, the strong friendship that exists, not just between Belgium and the United Kingdom, but all of the Commonwealth countries. You see lots of different people that come here, don't you?
Yes, during all the times, especially when we organise some events, we have met a lot of people from down under, Australia, New Zealand, from Canada, from India, and we make a lot of new friends. Good friends that's still coming back, that we are still have some connection with it.
Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to have a wander around today this enormous memorial, as I say, runs round the north side of the Tynecott Cemetery. And when you stand here and you look across today, oh, another person has turned up. Look, they really have to be brave, hardy souls to come out here on a day like this. And it always makes you wonder as well how those guys felt during those winter months when the fighting officially stopped, but the killing went on and they still had to try and survive in these conditions. It must have been, it's just unimaginable, isn't it?
Yes, if you look to the landscape, you can see it's a very hillside landscape, small hills, some valleys, but everything was turned into one swamp of mud, drowning people and machine during these horrible days. Lots of shelling, which means a lot of people were hit by these shell fragments. They fell over, they disappeared in the mud, and their bodies were never found back again.
They're still here, aren't they? Still here beneath the grass.
Maybe they were found back, but no way to identify them. And that became a big issue for the British government, because they want to commemorate every single soldier, but they have a problem with the missing, and they want to make sure that the relatives have something that they can go to, that they have a symbol to commemorate their missing soldier. And that became a big problem. And there came a proposition from Australia, maybe we can commemorate all these missing soldiers by a symbolic headstone. But that was financially impossible, because in Belgium more than 100,000 British soldiers were missing. Then another proposition came, maybe we can engrave the names of the missings in the walls of the cemeteries nearby. But that was practical, not possible, because lots of people went missing and they don't know exactly on what location.
They wouldn't know where to put the memorial, yes. Would they? Which cemetery?
And then they decided we're going to do it in front zones. And here in Belgium we have three zones. And the major zone where they're going to put their national memorial on is Ypres. Ypres, a very medieval town with medieval town gates. We have the Menin Gate, so nearly every soldier passed the Menin Gate towards the battlefields, and this is where they're going to build the Menin Gate memorial. And they calculated about 60,000 names could be engraved in the Menin Gate. But like I said, 100,000 names. Then they decided to build a second memorial at the Passchendaele front zone here on Tynecott, and a third one on the Plug Street front, where they will commemorate all the missing from the Plug Street and the Douve area in France. They also decided to put all the names of the overseas countries on the Meningate. For example, if they would do it by date, like Terry already mentioned, August 16th, 1917 was the date where they're going to put all the names on the time codes. Well, we would have nearly all the names of the Australians on the time code walls and nearly none on the Meningate. So therefore, they decided to put all the overseas areas on the Meningate. So like Australia, India, South Africa, they were all on the Meningate, Canada. Then after August the 16th, they started here with the names. On the Meningate, about 54,000 names. And then here on this big wall, about 35,000 names.
Wow. Where do we start? We start the cemetery on the left-hand side. We start panel number one. I remember looking at this before, and the one that sticks out to me straight away is Zebedee. Because Zebedee is a character in a children's television program from the 60s and 70s called Magic Roundabout. Did we know anything about Zebedee?
No.
That's one I'm going to have to investigate.
Yes. That's a new point to investigate. Yes. So indeed, we're at the northwest part of the wall. A wall which is in a half circle representing the Ypres Salient. It's about 230 meters long. Two kiosks with an angel on top of it, three roundabouts or three apses, and altogether about 166 panels. And all these panels are formed by the rank of importance in the British Army. So panel number one would be the Royal Marines, the Light Infantry, because in the 1850s, Queen Victoria ordered to form a Light Infantry Battalion from the Royal Marines. And they were here active already in in August 1914. Not in Passchendaele, but in Ostende.
Yeah.
Which they landed in Ostende and they want to help the Belgian army in Antwerp. But they were also here in 1917, especially in October 1917. Then we have the cavalry, artillery, engineers, and then we come up to the British regiments by the date of their performance of their estimate date.
So they're not listed for people that come in alphabetical order at all,
are they? No.
The names are within the ranks, but not the regiments.
That's by an official list of importance made by the British government. And they ending with London regiments and the new formed battalions like the Royal Flying Corps, the Tank Corps, Machine Gun Corps.
Because they came along later?
Yes, because they were formed already during the war or just before the war.
So it's almost a chronological order then, as we would call it in England. Yeah.
So if you look here to the Royal Marines, we had two battalions, the 1st Royal and the 2nd Royal Marines. They were here in October, coming from maybe for some of you guys, listeners, a very famous place, Varlet Farm, which is now a bed and breakfast.
Yep.
And they support the British troops here in October and beginning November 1917.
And they've got, I noticed that the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve, although they're infantry, can see that their ranks are still naval, aren't they?
Yes, they're still carrying the naval ranks. But if you look to the Royal Marines, then you will see some military ranks.
Yes.
Like Captain, Sergeant Major, Lance Corporal. Yeah. But if you look to the Royal Naval Volunteers, you can see the petty officers, the able seamen, the leading seamen. And all kinds of
They didn't even,
because they are still under order of the Royal Navy,
but they were leading on the land rather than the sea.
And under command of Sir Winston Churchill. Yeah?
Yes, it was his idea, wasn't it?
So if we move further to panel 3-4, you can see the household battalions, the horse and the field artilleries. So a lot of the household and the artillery regiments that were also here, especially in 1914, when cavalry was still important, but very soon it turns out that cavalry was at the end of their active service.
And these are very famous regiments that go back centuries, really, don't they?
To
previous conflicts, we're familiar with a lot of them from like the Crimea and even Waterloo, maybe some of these.
Even before Civil War.
Yeah.
And if you take a look, sometimes you can see some titles in front of them, like Honourable or Lords or something. And I'm going to show you, or I'm going to tell you a story about one that is mentioned here.
Okay.
On panel number 7.
Panel number 7, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, it's a Honourable Artillery Company.
Yeah.
If you take a look to the list of names, we have three list of names.
Yes.
About 40 to 50 names in every rank. And if you go to the middle rank, the middle list, right on the bottom, you can see Howard's Honourable MFS, Howard. Michael Francis Stafford.
Who was he then?
Michael Francis Stafford came from a very, very noble family. His parents were relatives to the royal houses of Great Britain and of Scotland, of England and Scotland. But he was an adventurer. He was a restless young man. He wandered the world around, became in trouble everywhere where he gets.
Got in trouble everywhere he went.
Oh, yeah.
Thought every very British young, soldier was restless. An angel, a hero, but clearly not.
No. And he also had a big problem because he had an alcohol problem, as they said.
Yeah.
And that, make sure that he has a lot of trouble also with this alcohol problem. When the war broke out, he lived in Canada as a farmer.
Okay.
He served before during the Boer War.
Right.
I'm going to take a look to my papers. He served with, just take me a look, with the 18th Hussars.
Yeah.
And when the war broke out, he came back to England and he retook his rank with the Royal Hussars. He became a lieutenant and he was sent to Belgium, to the front. But because of his drinking problem, like I said, lots of trouble. And he was court-martialed. But because of his brother, that was a major, he could avoid
his brother pulled strings, did he?
Yeah. Okay. And he was sent to India. To South Africa, sorry.
To South
East,
Africa.
East Africa. East Africa.
Still a war zone though.
Still a war zone, yeah.
Still fighting.
East
the
Africa. Yeah. And suddenly in January 1917 he was dismissed and sent back.
Oh. More Belgium. Alcohol, do we think?
Yeah, we don't know. Couldn't find anything.
No.
And about a few weeks later, he re-enlisted in the army as a private.
Ah.
And he was enlisted to the Honourable Artillery Company. And on October the 9th, they were on action in the hamlet of Reutel.
This is a famous date, isn't it? October the 9th.
October the 9th is a very bloody day, also known as the Battle of Poelcapelle. And he got killed.
Right.
And his body was never found back or was never identified.
Yes.
Which was a little bit of a problem for his widow, because she received just a soldier's pension instead of a officer's pension, because he was a high ranked officer and before and of honourable rankings.
Because he's listed there, isn't he, as a private under the
as
HAC.
A private, yeah. But just before he died, his wife gave a birth to a twin.
Oh,
yeah, a girl and a boy.
Yeah.
And his girl, Geraldine, became a doctor, medicine doctor.
Yeah.
Specialized in children therapy.
Right.
And she became a very famous doctor. Ah. She married with Hubert Jolly.
Yeah.
Which also was a very famous doctor. He wrote some books about children therapy and take care of the children. They got a son. And then his youngest boy, he joined the army also in the 1930s. And he died in 1943 as a prisoner of war, as a prisoner from Japan. He is buried in Hong Kong.
Oh, so he's left quite a legacy then, hasn't he?
Yes.
A good legacy and then a sad legacy as well.
And his brother, which held hands above his head. He survived the war, he got married, he also got children. And two of his sons, one of his sons died during the landings of Normandy.
Oh, really?
During the Battle of Caen. He's buried in Caen, British Military Cemetery.
Yeah.
And his other son was a pilot. And he was a member of the so famous Dambusters. And he was shot down above Germany. And he is buried near Cologne.
So that's Howard's nephew then?
Howard's nephew.
His brother's son.
His brother's
son. So he was one of the Dambusters and he was shot down.
Yeah. Wow. His own son was killed as a prisoner of war.
Yeah.
That caused stabbed.
Yeah.
Was he stabbed by the guards, by bayonet or something in the camp or something? We don't know. Yeah. That's a very tragic story for the Howard family.
Just one name, lots of stories sit behind that, and it's another one of those where the two world wars overlap, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And the Howard Castle is still one of the most famous castles in England.
Where's that then?
It's in Yorkshire.
Oh, we'll have to go up there then.
Yeah, it has a very big garden.
Yeah.
About 500,000 square meters big, and it's known as the Kew at Castle Howard, and it has one of the most famous collections of trees and plants in Great Britain.
I wonder who it's owned by. Do we know?
It's still owned by the Howard family.
Because a lot of those homes have been sold off.
Yes, after the war, because
the National Trust or English
World
Heritage.
War One was a little bit the end of
that's
the aristocracy.
Right. And it costs so much money to keep these places going that they've fallen in. But it's good to see that Castle Howard is still within the family.
It's already appeared in a lot of television shows and films. Bargain hunt, or bargain hunt, antiques roadshow.
Antiques roadshow, all
this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And you still can visit the gardens, which brings some money.
Right. Yes, to keep the place going.
So we are here underneath the northwest side of the wall, underneath the kiosk. It's like a chapel. You can see some symbols on the ground of Passchendaele, of the upper area, the Lorraine Cross. But we can also see portals in the walls, some cabinets, bronze doors, marked memorial registers. In these cabinets, we have the books. First of all, we have a visitor's book, where you as a visitor can write a personal message down, but also a register with all the names of the people that are mentioned here on the walls in alphabetically order. So you just have to search your name of your relative, take a look, and behind the name you will find his panel number, and so you can find his name on the correct panel.
That's really, if you come in here and you've not been before and you're looking for a particular soldier, this is your first port of call, isn't it? You see these bronze doors with the cross on, memorial, and they're a feature in themselves, aren't they? They're a beautiful feature.
And we have the same on the entrance of the cemetery.
Yes.
But this is for the soldiers that are buried in the cemetery. The known soldiers, of course, not the unknown. The Commonwealth commemorates about 205,000 British soldiers in Belgium from both wars. And about the half of them don't have a grave. So 101,000 are missing. And if we take a look to the cemeteries, we can tell about four soldiers, two of them have a known grave. Another one is buried as an unknown soldier, and another soldier is still somewhere in the fields. So about 50% is unknown, and another half of them don't have a grave.
Yes. Yeah. They're still out there somewhere.
Still out somewhere, hoping to be found one day.
They're still finding them, though, aren't they?
They're still finding the remains, yes. And some of them are reported to the police. Others will never be reported. They just disappear on the truck or under the concrete. And
lost forever then.
Lost forever. And other people will be never found again because, if you have been hit by a shell of about 200 pounds just in front of you,
it's not going to be nothing much
there. There will be nothing but shell left of
you.
So we are now looking to the infantry regiments, Cumberland Fusiliers.
Of which there are many, aren't there? Because
there are five battalions or five regiments here on the wall with more than 1,000 names.
1,000, this is one of them.
Yes. And the Northumberlands is one of them. Then we have the Machine Gun Corps, the Lancashire Fusiliers, the Royal Warwickshires, and the West Yorks. These five regiments have...
And it's not surprising they come in, they are large regiments.
Yes,
they're coming
they
from big conurbations like Leeds, Birmingham, Newcastle, Sunderland, those sort of places.
And if you take a look here, panel number 19, which is the first panel for the Northumberland Fusiliers. And if you take a look to the first names, you can see captains, three captains, then a few lieutenants.
Yeah.
And underneath, Ablett has got a grave, but he's still on the wall.
Yes.
In 2019, during roadworks at Hamlet of Reutel, the archaeologists find a trench with nine bodies. And a little bit further, eight bodies, and a little further, they found the ninth body. And very soon they saw there were Northumberland Fusiliers because of their shoulder titles. so the investigation could start. When were the Northumberlands here? So the 20th and the 21st of October 1917. And they start to look to the bodies, and one of the bodies, Lieutenant Ablett, had a golden wedding ring on his finger. And his name and the name of his spouse were in the wedding ring.
Really?
So immediately they could say, okay, this is Lieutenant Ablett. And during of the war, regimental war diaries, they could find out who was with him.
Who was with him, yeah.
When they went missing.
Yeah.
And so they were able to identify 7 of the 8 soldiers. The 9th soldier that was found a little bit further was impossible to identify. Not either a regiment. He was reburied together with the others in 2021 here on Tynecott Cemetery.
You were here, weren't you?
Yeah, it was a very terrible weather. Yeah. They're buried on the bottom of the cemetery. If you enter from the back to the left-hand corner, complete presence of the Duke of Kent.
And it was featured in a TV documentary, I recall, as well.
Yes. So the names of the 7 Northumberland Fusiliers are still here on the walls. But if you will take a look to the Commonwealth War Graves website, you will see that they have a grave.
Yeah.
So they only have one place where they are remembered. But their names are still here, and maybe sometime in the future they will remove their names.
Maybe when they replace the panel, isn't it?
When they replace the panels.
Yeah. Yeah. We see the Royal Warwickshire, which you mentioned, is another one of those regiments that's got over 1,000 casualties here. And we come to panel 27 under the Royal Warwickshire's. Johan is pointing to a number of Smiths, is that right? Is that what you're pointing at?
Yes, because if you want to do some research to your relative, for example, my great-great-uncle or great-grandfather was called Frederick Smith. He was missing. And you come to Tynecott, to the wall. Oh, there's a lot of Smith Fredericks on the wall.
Yeah.
Who is my relative? So therefore, the Commonwealth has placed their regimental number behind their names, so that you are sure that you are here and looking and commemorate the correct name of your relatives. So you can see a lot of numbers behind the names Smith F, Smith W, so the Williams, so a lot of them will have their regimental number behind them.
And even relatively unfamiliar names as well, like Stokes, there's 2A Stokes with their regimental numbers next to them, and down the bottom there's 2 Taylors as well, there's Perks and GH Perks. Like, you know, they could well have been related, couldn't they? But Smiths, there's so many Smiths in England,
so
that's
Smiths,
why it's important,
so
that their numbers are there.
Yeah,
that's good thinking, isn't it?
Yeah. It's just a name, but it's so important for
it
the
is.
Relative
yeah.
to be at the correct name.
Yes. Yeah, if you come all this way, you don't want any doubt, just that you're looking at the right name, especially if that's all you've got.
Yeah. But this first apsis have the names of 3 special soldiers. They are all special, but 3 Victoria Cross recipients.
Okay.
So during World War I, the Victoria Cross was gained by a lot of soldiers, and not everybody survived, and not everybody has a grave. So 3 of them are here mentioned on the walls.
And they're posthumously, aren't they? So
We're going to start at panel number 50, and the first name we see, V.C. Bent Philip Eric DSO. And Philip Eric Bent was eventually a Canadian. He was born in Halifax, Canada.
Oh yeah.
But with his parents, he emigrated to England, and he went living into Edinburgh. So he went to Scotland. He joined the Royal Navy in 1909, and he became a very good soldier. After his territorial service, he went to the Merchant Navy, just as to work as a sailor. And when war broke out, he enlisted and he became a member of the Royal Scotch. He became a second lieutenant in December 1914 and was appointed to the Leicester Regiment. Promoted lieutenant in 1915, transferred to the 9th Battalion, the Leicesters, and after 9 months of home training, he came to France. And he made big career, because already in July 1916 he was promoted to colonel, and he was very loved by his men.
So he's leading a battalion commander, isn't he? He's a lieutenant colonel.
Lieutenant colonel.
But he's risen up, really, isn't he?
Battalion. Yeah. He was a few times wounded, but he always remained at duty. And on the 31st of October, on the 1st of October, sorry, not the 31st, the 1st of October, he was killed during an action at Polygon Woods in Zonnebeek.
Yeah.
And for his action, he was receiving the Victoria Cross. And as you might know, the citation goes in the London Gazette.
Yes.
And this is the citation for Lieutenant Colonel Bent. So, second Lieutenant Colonel Philip Eric Bent, for most conspicuous bravery, when during a heavy hostile attack, the right of his own command and the battalion on his right were forced back. The situation was critical owing to the confusion caused by the attack and the intense artillery fire. Lieutenant Colonel Bent personally collected a platoon that was in reserve, and together with men from other companies and various regimental details, he organized and led forward to the counterattack, after issuing orders to the other officers as to the further defense of the line. The counterattack was successful and the enemy were checked. The coolness and magnificent example shown to all ranks by Lieutenant Colonel Bent results in the securing of a portion of the line, which was of essential importance for subsequent operations. This very gallant officer was killed while leading a charge which he inspired with the call, "Come on, Tigers!"
Come on, the Tigers, the nickname of the Leicestershire Regiment, and the nickname still used today as the name of the Leicester Rugby Union team. With these awards, what I've noticed looking at while you were talking there, looking at a lot of the soldiers have got awards there, DCM, Distinguished Conduct Medal, Military Medal, Military Cross, but the VC, that usually the awards are listed after their names, but not the VC. They're in the left-hand column, yeah. Aren't they? Left-hand margin almost.
Yes, the Victoria Cross is the most important medal in the British Army.
So it sticks out, doesn't it?
It sticks out. It's in front of the name. It's also the first medal that you can wear on your ribbon or on your breast. It's always the Victoria Cross.
Yeah.
So what happened with the medal, his posthumous Victoria Cross, together with the DSO, which is a Distinguished Service Order, was presented to his mother at Buckingham Palace on the 2nd of March 1918. And in 1923, she presented her son's medals to his former school in Ashby de la Zouch Grammar School,
yep,
for safekeeping and safeguarding, to serve as the lasting stimulants of the high ideals. And in 1972, the medals were permanently loaned to the Royal Leicester Regiment Museum. But in 2017, there was an issue because the school wanted to sell the medals for fundraising to build a new school.
Okay.
So there was a lot of protest against it. Can we sell it?
Can we sell it?
Yeah. They didn't sell them.
They did.
They are still in the Royal Museum.
It's good to hear, because sometimes these medals get lost, don't they?
Yeah, or get in the private collections.
Yeah. As you say, he's been awarded not just the Victoria Cross, he's got the DSO, Distinguished Service Order as well. Yeah.
And if we look two panels further, panel 52,
two.
On the left bottom by the regiment, the Yorkshire Regiment,
yeah.
Corporal V.C. Clamp.
So
William.
we've gone from a lieutenant colonel all the way down to a corporate, but still a V.C. award winner posthumously.
Yep. He was born in 1891, and he served with the 6th Battalion Yorkshire Regiment. There's not so much known about William Clamp, and his citation was he was killed October the 9th, 1917, during the Battle of Bull Kapal. He went to the Cranewick Primary School, yeah, that is what we know.
Yeah.
And he was a member of the Good Templar Lodge.
So he's a Scotsman. Yeah, he's come from Motherwell,
Lanarkshire.
Motherwell, the Yorkshire.
Yeah, probably the Yorks. And he was the oldest of 16 children.
16?
16.
Blimey.
Yep. he was wounded a few times before he was killed during the war. And in his last letter home to his mother, he wrote, "Don't worry about me, mother, for whatever happens, my soul is right with God. And on October the 9th at Bull Kapal, when an advance was being checked by intense machine gun fire from concrete blockhouses and by snipers in ruined buildings, Corporal Clamp dashed forwards with two men and attempted to rush the large blockhouse. His first attempt failed. owing to the two men with him being knocked out. But he had at once collected some bombs and calling upon two men to follow him, again dashing forwards. He was first to reach the blockhouse and hurled in bombs, killing many of the occupants. He then entered and brought out a machine gun and about 20 prisoners, whom he brought back under heavy fire from neighboring snipers. This non-commissioned officer then again went forward, encouraging and cheering the men, and succeeded in rushing several sniper posts. Shortly afterwards, William was hit and killed by a sniper, and sadly his body was not recovered. He has commemorated here, thank God. For this actions, he was awarded the Victoria Cross, which was presented to his parents by King George V at Buckingham Palace, March 2, 1918. He was also awarded the 1915 Star Trio. When his parents died, the Victoria Cross passed to his brother James, then after his death to his sister Jessie, and she sold the medals to the Yorkshire Regiments in 1967. And it's now still in hands of the Green Howards Museum in Richmond,
Yorkshire. Well, his luck's run out, hasn't it? Because he's taken too many risks, really, hasn't he? For all the right reasons. But a bit like the two Australians in the cemetery, it's a similar action. Eventually, his luck's run out.
Yep.
And he must have known. He must have known that the
sooner or later, you know,
he was going to get. Yep. He was leading his men, wasn't he?
Yes, yes, yes. So if you hear art, panel 65.
Yep.
On the right, the left upper corner, we're at the Royal Welsh Fusiliers.
Yes.
You can see the privates.
Yes.
And suddenly in the list of privates, there's a name.
There's a gap.
A gap.
Yeah.
So probably somebody that was recovered.
Yeah.
A few years ago, and they removed his
removed
name.
His name.
And filled up the gap.
So between J. O'Grady and T. Owen, there's a gap there on panel 65, Royal Welsh Fusiliers. And that means that whoever the name was there has now have a grave here, or at Poker Pell, or at New Irish Farm, or somewhere like that,
cement house,
one
somewhere
of the big cemeteries, most probably, which is good news.
Yes,
he's no longer missing.
Nope. And therefore, the figures on the wall and the cemetery always change.
Yes, it's
so
never.
Therefore, we always said there are about 12,000 buried, about 35,000.
Yes.
Then we find on panel number 7, they made a mistake during making the panels and put the VC behind his name. So they corrected it and put the VC
into the left hand side. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is Eric Seaman, is it?
Ernest. This is
Ernest Seaman.
Ernest Seaman, who was born in the area of Norwich, in Higham, Norwich.
Yeah.
His father died when he was very young. His mother remarried, and they moved to school, not so far from Norfolk.
Yeah.
He left school at 14. Went working, and in 1912 he immigrated to Canada to find
a lot of
job.
People did, didn't they?
Yes, yes, to find a better way,
better
because
life.
There's a lot of farming grounds available in those days.
And they wanted the people, didn't they? Wanted
yes,
the people
yes,
to come
yes.
over to Canada to help.
And when war breaks out, he returned to England in 1915, and he tried to enlist the army, but he was turned down because he was medical unfit.
Oh.
He tried again, and on the 26th of December 1915, he was enlisted, and he could join the Army Service Corps and work as a baker. So they need bakers too, eh?
Yes.
Not just soldiers, but they need the logistics.
Army marches on its stomach.
Yeah. The bakers, the butchers, the veterinaries, they need them all, eh? But in 1917, the British Army lost so much men, so they need a lot of new people. And he was take up to the infantry. And he joined the 2nd Battalion Royal Inniskilling Fusiliers.
So he's got no connection with Ireland at all, has he? He's a Norfolk boy, been to Canada. And at this stage in the war, you go. You don't have a choice.
Nope.
You get placed where there's a need.
Yeah, we need you. You go there.
Yeah.
And he was killed nearly at the end of the war. He was killed the 29th of September 1918 during the Liberation Offensive.
So are they over the Passchendaele Ridge at this
stage? Yes, over the Passchendaele Ridge.
In the green fields?
Yes, very close to Menin.
Yeah.
In a village of a hamlet known Der Hand, in the village of Geluwe, which is just before Menin. They had an action. So I'm going to write a citation. So the 29th of September 1918, when the right flank of his company was held up by a nest of enemy machine guns, Lance Corporal Seaman, with great courage and initiative, rushed forwards under heavy fire with his Lewis gun and engaged the machine gun position single-handed, capturing two machine guns and 12 prisoners, and killing one officer and two men. Later in the day, he again rushed another enemy gun post, capturing the gun under very, very heavy fire. He was killed immediately afterwards. Commanding officer, Captain Matlock, he said that he did a very good job and he would be recommended for the military medal. That would be a good,
yeah,
a good reward. Give him the military medal.
Yeah.
But he was incorrect. They didn't give him the military medal. He received the Victoria Cross.
There's a big difference between the military medal and the Victoria Cross.
And on the 13th of February 1919, his mother received the Victoria Cross in Buckingham Palace from King George V. And in the early 1940s, the medal was donated to the trustees of the Royal Army Service Corps, and it's still there in their museum. And a replica medal is on display in the RCT medal collection of the Officer Mess of the Royal Logistic Corps at Deepcut in Surrey.
Oh, yeah. What gets me about him is that right at the start of that story, he was turned down by the army because he wasn't medically fit.
Yeah.
Less than 3 years later, he's killed and is awarded the Victoria Cross. That's a man who at first wasn't fit enough, but certainly did prove that he was fit.
Different
to the summer when you come here and there can be hundreds of people here, can't there? And
especially in the tourist season, you're never alone here.
No, that's right. And here we come to a very special area, isn't it? Don't we?
New Zealand.
Taken by the New Zealand government, was it?
Yeah, they didn't agree that all the overseas areas have to put their missing on the Menin Gate.
Yeah.
They want to commemorate them where they were killed. So the New Zealanders have three special memorials here in Belgium. We have one at Polygon Wood Cemetery, the Butters New Zealand Memorial to the Missing. We have one at Messine Ridge Cemetery, and the third one is here at Tynecott, which is in the Middle Asp, where we have about 1,100 names of missing New Zealanders.
And they're in those three locations because that's where they served.
Because this is where they served and where they were died. So the 1,100 names here were all killed in October, November 1917 here during the battles of Passchendaele.
And as it says in the middle of their names, here are recorded the names of officers and men of New Zealand who fell in the battles of Brusinda. Is that how you pronounce it? Brusinda Ridge. And the first battle of Passchendaele, October 1917, and whose graves are none known only to God.
Yeah. And if we take a look, there are nine panels with typical British names, but sometimes you can see special names. Okay. You can see Espasessi, we can see an Kios, we can see a lot of immigrants.
Yes.
Lots of these people went to New Zealand. Why? Because lots of them want to go to Australia. But just before the war, Australia has put down an immigration stop. They only allowed people from New Zealand to emigrate to Australia.
Only New Zealanders?
Yeah.
No more Brits, more Poms.
No more Europeans. So a lot of Europeans went to New Zealand and then tried to emigrate
indirect
to Australia.
Ah, right.
And we have a few special stories. If you take a look to panel number two.
Yeah.
On your left corner, Auckland Infantry. If you take a look to the fifth name, you can see New Love, LC.
Yes.
Leonard Charles.
Yes.
If we then go to panel number three.
Yes.
And right in the middle, we can see two names of, this is a Canterbury Infantry Regiment, New Love, E. Edwin, and New Love, Leslie Marcus.
So we've got three brothers.
Three brothers from Auckland. Leonard was killed October the 4th during the Battle of Broodseinde near Schraventafelspur. He was buried on the temporary cemetery near Waterloo Farm. Edwin was killed October the 12th. He jumped out of his trench. He was shot. His body was never found back again. And Leonard was also killed the 12th, but we don't know how.
No.
He was also buried on Waterloo Farm, but later battles destroyed the cemetery, and their bodies could never be identified again. Maybe they are buried here, maybe they are buried, or maybe they are still in the
fields. Ernest and Leonard, was it? Those two. Were they serving together then in the Canterbury's? Were they together? Yeah. And the third brother
was in the Auckland's.
He's serving with the Auckland, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah.
So then they're not all together, are they? The third one is. Is that a picture of them?
Yeah, here a picture of them during training.
He's a bit of a lad. Look at him. Look at his hat.
Yeah, that's Leslie. Leslie, Leonard and Edwin.
I'd love to have met them. I
imagine. But no, you must imagine. We are here in Belgium, Passchendaele.
Yeah, a long way from New Zealand.
New Zealand is the farthest spot that we can go to travel.
Yeah.
Because if you go to New Zealand and we go further, we are coming back.
We're coming back on ourselves, yeah.
So now you have to imagine that somebody has to go from the post office or something to a young mother to tell that three of her boys were killed in a week time.
Within a week.
In a country of which she has never heard of, and that they don't have a grave to place a flower on. These are of the 100,000 family tragedies.
So she has no closure for any of her three sons. Because I bet you she spent the rest of her life thinking, I wonder if they are dead. I wonder if one day they'll come back through that door.
And the problem is with Australians, New Zealanders, Canadians a little bit less, they can't get here.
No.
Because a voyage from New Zealand to Belgium in those days was with ship, was about 3 months.
And a lot of money.
And a lot of money. So it was only about the 1960s, 1970s when the mass tourism started that these New Zealanders could come on a pilgrimage.
I wonder if any of the New Love family have been here. You haven't met anyone, have you?
I haven't. Yet. I think they were here. They had connections with the museum, but I have never
met them. Well, that's why it's important that we do this, isn't it? We tell their stories.
And if we take a look to panel number 4, where on the right column in the middle, we can see a name of Kios K.
Yeah, I was just wondering about that. Served as Curtis.
Served as Curtis.
What's he up to?
Kios Karl. He was from Sweden. We don't know why he changed his name. Was he wanted by the government?
Yeah.
Was he a deserter? Was he a criminal?
A bigamist? Was he a bigamist, weren't they?
Bigamist, too young?
Yeah.
Maybe afraid for his name that they would say, you have German connections or something?
Yeah, it could be that, yeah.
We don't know. We can't find why he changed his name.
Right.
It's still a mystery.
Okay.
But he enlisted as Carl Curtis, and after the war, when he was died and they do the research, they found out that his name was Carl Kios. That he wasn't a New Zealander, but...
There is a guy I've seen on Twitter who's researching all the Swedes, isn't there? Can't remember his name. Have you seen him? No. I'll get in touch with him on Twitter and see if he knows anything about it. Might be able to shed some more light on it.
Yes, absolutely.
I've forgotten the guy's name now, so I'll look it up.
Absolutely.
What else have we got here, then?
Yeah, like I see...
Lots of stories within this 1,100 New Zealanders.
1,100 names, there's 1,100 stories there.
Yeah.
Like here, for example, panel number 7. Spassessi.
Spassessi,
coming from Malta.
Oh, Maltese.
Yeah, Maltese, Italian. Immigrants, immigrants.
Yeah.
We have a guy here named Bowles,
which
is typical Dutch name, Flemish Dutch name.
Right, yeah.
You know, this Bowles is from Holland. He's a Hollander.
So do you think he was Dutch, or just a Dutch
name? He was Dutch.
He's gone...
Maybe his parents emigrated.
He's gone from this part of the world to New Zealand. He's come back here. Fair enough. Been killed, and here he remains for eternity.
Yes, we have a story, but it's not on the here, it's on the Menigay, of somebody of the village of Rooselare, which is just the next village of Passchendaele. He emigrated to Canada. He joined the Canadian Army, and he was killed in November 1917 in Passchendaele, about 5 kilometers from his birth house, and he is commemorated on the Menigay. So we are here in the third roundabout, in the dirt asp. And if you go to panel number 108, we're looking to the Coilies, the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry. And the first name we will see is Lieutenant Colonel Morehouse, Harry. Then we have Captain. And if we look to the fourth name of the captains, we can see Morehouse Ronald, father and son.
Father and son. So Harry is commanding the battalion. Ninth, I think. Was it top of my head?
Yes. He was a battalion there, and Ronald, his son, went into action, also again, October the 9th, the Battle of Pulkapelle, ordering the 4th Battalion, Coilies. They went into action, but he was killed. His father, was in the headquarters, and when he receiving the news about a half hour later that his son was killed and left behind on the battlefield, he went out of his shelter. He wanted to find back his son.
He's gone looking for him, his boy, isn't he?
And at that moment, a German shell collapsed, killing Lieutenant Colonel Morehouse.
Gosh.
So father and son were both killed in half hour time, and they both don't have a grave to remember them. So they are both still missing or buried as an unknown soldier somewhere.
Both distinguished. Harry's got a Distinguished Service Order. And Ronald has been awarded the Military Cross, hasn't he?
Yep.
The only father and son that we know of,
yep,
that died in the Third Battle of Ypres.
Yep.
Certainly the only father and son that we know of that's remembered here.
Yep. We had a lot of brothers.
A lot of brothers, but Matthews, this is different, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is different.
Father and son, yeah.
That's yeah.
So we are here now at panel 148, which is the last panel of the infantry. The regular infantry battalions, ending with the Cambridgeshire, and then we start with the London battalions. So there were a lot of London battalions active here in the area. The first battalions, known as the Royal Fusiliers, going up to the Queen Victoria's, to the Artist Rifles. So about 32 London battalions are mentioned here on these panels.
Finish still goes up, still more London battalions. We're now up to there's one name listed under the 33rd Battalion of London Regiment, a Private W. Towerton.
So we just passed the south, the northeast pavilion, so the end of the wall. We are here now at panel 154, and here we have what we call the new formed battalions, like Machine Gun Corps. Then we move further on, where we have Army Service Corps, Tank Corps, Labour Corpses. And on panel 160, we have the Royal Army Chaplain Department.
Yes.
Because there are also a few chaplains missing here.
Yes.
And here we have the name of five chaplains. New Zealand has one.
Yes, I noticed there was one on the New Zealand one.
The most famous name that is mentioned here is Father William Doyle, who was an Irish chaplain. He was killed in August 1917 near Friesenberg. His body was never recovered. But we also have the name of a Clark, Eyre, Harding, and Dallas. And Dallas was a missionary, and he was mainly in Argentina. And when war broke out, he came back to serve as a padre in the army. And he got killed here during the Battle of Passchendaele. The panel next, 161, is the final panel of the wall, the final official panel.
Yes.
Ending with Corps of Military Police and Channel Island Militia. And if we take a look to the Channel Island Militia, we can see two names: Gallieni A 704, Gallieni A number 1665.
Unusual names.
Unusual names. Italian names.
Italian.
Italians. Twins.
But they're coming from the Channel Islands.
Yep. I'm going to take my other book.
Yep.
Just 1 minute.
Take time, mate. And as Johan's talking there, I just turn around now. It's been a dreadful few days, and Johan said that they've seen no sun in this part of Belgium for weeks. It's before Christmas, but it's still perishing cold here, and one wonders how those soldiers lived, let alone fought, in these conditions. But as we look back across the width of the cemetery, back to where we started, at the other side of the memorial, the sun is now shining on the cross of sacrifice and is creating shadows across most of the headstones that are in the upper part of the cemetery here. It really is quite a sight. Beautiful. The wind is not as strong as it was. It's just blowing the trees and the bushes. But it looks completely different to how it does when you come here in the middle of summer, doesn't it? Completely different. The sun is much lower, of course. Everything looks different. Even Tynecock can look different, not just in the different seasons, but at different times of the day as well, doesn't it? As you know, as Johan knows, because he lives here. What have you discovered now for me?
So I have look to the names of the two Gallienis. So we have Gallieni Archibald and Gallieni Adolphus. Like I said, they were twins. Their family was originally from Italy, but during history they moved to the UK, and they moved to the Channel Islands, to Gurney Islands. And on the 21st of March 1918, so after the Battle of Passchendaele, they have to went to patrol. And when the patrol came back, Archibald was not with him. His twin brother, Adolphus, yeah, he felt lost. He lost his twin brother. He don't know where he was. And 2 days later, a new patrol was sent out, and Adolphus volunteered to join the second patrol to search for the body of his brother.
They're looking for his brother, doesn't he?
And he didn't came back neither. Yeah. So they were both killed. And during two officially archives and diaries, they were both killed by snipers, probably.
This is March 1918.
March 1918, time, just before the start of this German Spring Offensive.
Yeah, or the Lees Offensive. Yeah.
And another Gallieni, another brother, Thomas, was killed in November 1917 in France. And he's also commemorated on a memorial to the missing.
And he's a brother as well. So two twins and a separate brother. All killed.
And none of them have a grave.
None of them have a grave.
No. And again, and they were the sons of Thomas and Eliza de Cattere.
Thomas and Eliza never knew what happened.
And then underneath the final name of the final regiment is the Royal Newfoundland Regiment, Second Lieutenant Barrett. Yeah. He's the only Newfoundlander that is commemorated here.
Yeah.
Because just like the New Zealanders, Newfoundland decided to commemorate their missing somewhere else. And they decided to commemorate them all in Beaumont-Hamel, Caribou Park, the Newfoundland Memorial.
Well, we have an exception.
But we have an exception, somebody that was found probably a few days later after the inauguration, and they decided to put them here. And then we have four more panels. These are the addendas. People that were forgotten to put on the list, people that were found years afterwards, or some mistakes that they have to make sure that their names is on it.
And the same, we see that on all of the memorials for the missing at Teepvale.
Yeah, there's always an addendum.
There are several addendums there, and they're being added to all the time, aren't they? We're finding more and more people that have been forgotten about in history. No one's fault, it just happens, doesn't it?
Yeah, and also because of, now we're living in a time.
We've got more information available, haven't we?
Digital available, more access to more files. Mm. In those days, everything was handwritten to each other, and a mistake was very fast made. Also because they had to do hundreds of thousands of names. So they don't really have the time to do a proper investigation.
Yeah, and cross-checking at the time, it was almost impossible to do. That's absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much. So, we've now done, a couple of years ago, as I said, we looked at some of the names here in the cemetery. We've now looked at some of the names, just a few of the names, really. We haven't even scratched the surface, really, have we? But we'll keep going, won't we? Our investigations and your work here will never ever end, and I know that you collect medals as well, don't you, for these guys that are here. It's very personal to you, isn't it?
Like I said, I've grown up here. I'm a military collector, and my main part of collection goes about medals and memorial plaques of soldiers that are buried or commemorated here on Tynecott. Once I could buy one or receive one, I try to find out as much as possible information about this soldier so that I can tell on his story. And all these stories will be shared with the Passchendaele Knowledge Centre, which is attached to the Passchendaele Museum, where we have a project called the Passchendaele Archives. So if you have a relative that was killed, missing here during the Battle of Passchendaele, and you want to find out the information, just send a mail to the Passchendaele Archives Centre, and we will try to find out as much as possible information, and we'll send it to you for free so that you can keep commemorating
your relatives.
That's a great
service, isn't it? Yeah. I think that's going to be our third podcast then, isn't it? Looking at the stories behind the medals that you've collected.
Yep.
That's for another time, isn't it? But for now, Happy New Year, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Bye.
And just before we go, a couple of things. There's one story that I always tell when we go to the Tynecott Memorial. And that's a soldier that came from the 14th Battalion of the Royal Warwickshire Regiment. His name was Private Albert Ford. And just before he went over the top, as it was called, on the 26th of October 1977, he wrote on a scrap of paper a letter to his wife, and it said this: "My darling, if this should ever reach you, it will be a sure sign that I'm gone under. And what will become of you and the chicks, I do not know. But there is one above that will see to you and not let you starve. You've been the best of wives, and I loved you deeply. How much you'll never know. So, dear heart, I will bid you all farewell, hoping to meet you in the time to come, if there is a hereafter. Know that my last thoughts were of you in the dugout or on the fire step. My thoughts went out to you, the only one I ever loved, the one that made a man of me." And as I said, a few hours later, he was indeed killed. That last letter did reach his wife, Edith, and she treasured it for the rest of her life. She didn't marry again. She lived until 1956. And she said that as she died, she could see Albert in the corner of her bedroom. Albert said in that letter that if there is a hereafter, perhaps they'll meet again. Let's hope that there is a hereafter. Let's hope they did meet again. It would be nice to think so, wouldn't it? And before I forget, there's just one loose end that I need to tie up. Right at the beginning of the podcast, I noticed on panel number one, a soldier called Zebedee, which I referenced, was the name of a character in a children's programme from the 1970s that many of you will remember called Magic Roundabout. Well, I've searched the Commonwealth War Graves Commission records and indeed have found the record of Tom Zebedee serving with the Royal Marine Light Infantry. He was killed in action on the 6th of November 1917, so right at the end of the battle. He was from Salisbury in Wiltshire, and Zebedee, I've since discovered, is quite a common name in the southwest of England. He left behind a widow called Sophia and two children, Tom Jr., who was just 2 years old, an even younger child, daughter Muriel. She'd been born in November, the 20th of November 1916, so she was just a year old. I doubt very much, well, it's almost impossible, isn't it, for either of them to have any recollection of their father, who, when he died, was 39 years old. And as we go around Tynecott, it's very difficult when we look at the beautiful silent city that's there now to try and imagine what it was like during that Third Battle of Ypres. But I have here a memory of a Major G. Wade. He was serving with the South Staffordshires. He said, "Going up to the line for the first time, my first indication of the horrors to come appeared as a small lump on the side of the dockboard. I glanced at it as I went past and I saw to my horror that it was a human hand gripping the side of the track. No trace of the owner, just a glimpse of a muddy wrist and a piece of sleeve sticking out of the mud. After that, there were bodies every few yards, some lying face downwards in the mud, others showing by the expressions fixed on their faces the sort of effort they'd made to actually get back onto the track. Sometimes you could actually see blood seeping up from underneath. I saw the dead wherever I looked, a dead signaller still clinging to a basket cage with two dead pigeons in it, and further on, lying just off the track, two stretcher bearers with a dead man on a stretcher. There were the remains of a ration party that had been blown off the track. I remember seeing an arm still holding on to a water container. When the dead men were just muddy mounds by the trackside, it was not so bad. They were somehow impersonal. But what was unendurable were the bodies with upturned faces. Sometimes the eyes were gone and the faces were like skulls with the lips drawn back, as if they were looking at you with terrible amusement. Mercifully, a lot of those dreadful eyes were closed." Seems horrific as we read those words now. What must it have been like for Major Wade and the men that he was commanding as they were going into the line to experience the horrors that he just described that had befallen the men that had died, but thankfully he came through it. So that's the end of the podcast this week. Once again, thanks to Johan for taking up the time to come and join me and explain the stories, just a few of the stories, as we said, there on the Tynecott Memorial. There's lots more to come in the next few weeks. During the 3 days that I was over in Ypres, I recorded quite a bit for future podcasts. I don't know what's going to come next week. I shall decide closer to the time. But it will be something that we discovered as we walked and cycled and drove round the Ypres Passchendaele battlefields last week. And we're going to finish, as we normally do, with two things, really. A request that if you've enjoyed this podcast, you do rate and review it wherever you downloaded it from. And we're going to remember all those men that died in the horrors of Passchendaele that we've talked about this week. And indeed, all 34, nearly 35,000 of them, whose names are inscribed on that semicircular wall at the back of the Tynecott Cemetery by the plane of the last post.